Well, good morning, everybody. It's being hour being 8 o'clock, we'll call the meeting to order. And we do have a quorum. Greg Hubinger from the Legislative Commission is here. And while he's coming down and getting ready, Representative Elkins, have you read the minutes?
I have. Mr. Chair, I will move the approval.
Representative Elkins moves the approval of the minutes from the meeting of January 16th. All in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Ayes have it. Whenever you're ready, Mr. Hubinger.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Greg Hubinger with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. Thank you for inviting us here this morning to talk about the joint legislative offices and commissions that exist in the legislative branch. I'm going to provide a 10,000-foot level of the commissions and joint agencies, then talk a little bit about what the LCC is and does, and then talk about high level about our budget. And then the directors of the individual offices are here, and they will talk about a brief overview of their offices and a little bit about their budgets as well. You should have a handout in your folders that is titled the Joint Legislative Offices. I'm going to start first with an organizational chart that's on the second page. This chart shows all of the joint legislative offices and commissions that have been established by the legislature in law. These commissions and joint agencies support the work of the legislature. The joint agencies are shown on the left-hand side and include the Legislative Reference Library, the Legislative Auditor, the Revisor of Statutes, and the Legislative Budget Office. In the second column are the joint legislative commissions that have dedicated staff. And then in the right-hand side are the commissions and task forces that are staffed by the Legislative Coordinated Commission. Commissions are like committees, except that they generally include members of both the House and the Senate. Some commissions and councils also have citizen members that serve on them. All of these commissions are bipartisan, but importantly, all of the staff who work for these commissions and councils are nonpartisan. So in that way, we are like the staff in House Research and House Fiscal Analysis. I'm going to talk a little bit about the Legislative Coordinating Commission. That's that large box on the right-hand side. That's a commission that has 12 members, 6 members from the House, 6 members from the Senate, and includes the leadership from both bodies. The LCC coordinates the work of all the commissions and task forces, and then, as I indicated, supports some of the work of the other commissions and councils. I'm going to mention just a couple. The Subcommittee on Employee Relations is the small box on the bottom right. This is a 10-member subcommittee that has 5 members from the House and 5 from the Senate. This subcommittee reviews and provides interim approval of the labor contracts between the state and its 50,000 employees. These collective bargaining agreements cost about $8 billion, and so the legislature has always wanted to have close oversight of those contracts. A second group is the Region's Candidate Advisory Council. That's about 3 boxes up from the SER. That's a 24-member citizen council that's appointed by the Speaker and by the Senate. Those 24 members recruit and interview and then recommend candidates to serve on the Board of Regents of the University of Minnesota. That council completed its work last week. They had 50-some applications. They interviewed 25 candidates and are recommending 6 of them for the 4 open slots. You will be meeting in joint convention in March to elect those 4 new regents. A third group that I wanted to highlight is the Legislative Water Commission. That's in the second column bottom. That's a 12-member commission that has members from both the House and the Senate in equal numbers from each of the 4 caucuses. That commission does a deep dive into water policy issues and reviews the work of the various state agencies that work on this critical issue. Moving on to the next page in the handout is a summary budget of all of the commissions and task forces. The offices are listed on the left-hand side. The top third are represents the funding that comes from the general fund. The bottom half, roughly, is our other commissions and councils that receive funding through other revenue sources. Those budgets are approved in other committees. We show in our budget summary the actual spending for FY17, the appropriation for 18, the actual spending for 18, and then the allotment for 19. Our total budget is about $17.5 million. That represents about 20% of the overall budget for the legislature. in a way that's different than House committees. The budgets are actually appropriated to or allotted to the individual commissions and offices, so each of those manages their own budget. That's a quick overview from the 10,000-foot level. I think now we'll move into the individual presentations. Senator Senjum is here to talk about the Mississippi River Parkway Commission, one of our commissions. He'll talk about that, and then we'll move back to the list on the agenda.
Welcome to the committee, Senator. State your name for the tape. And
Senator Dave Senjum from Rochester. Pleasure to be here, Mr. Chair and members, to talk about the Mississippi Parkway Commission. So that's your pleasure. Ready?
Go ahead.
Okay. So I just want to stop by this morning. Representative Sheldon Johnson, had he not retired, would have been here today. Sheldon has been the chair of the Mississippi River Parkway Commission for maybe some number of years now, long enough to have really contributed substantially, I will tell you that. And I have been a member of this also since 2003, and I would characterize it, it's, as you can see, perhaps, if I think you have this in your packet, but if you don't, that's fine. It's a $63,000 biennial budget, and I would say with that $63,000, this little commission probably, which no one hardly knows about, probably does more good work than any other commission I can think of within the framework of state government. But nonetheless, we're about the Mississippi River. You have to, I think, be in the commission. We all know the greatness of the Mississippi River. You don't really realize the total greatness, I think, until you get on the commission and you hear of all the inquiries that come from, frankly, all over the world wanting information on, if you will, the Great River. It's a fantastic resource from many aspects, recreation, certainly commerce, and so on and so forth. So we have this 15-member commission. It's it comprises of 15 members, but 4 members of the legislature. Senator Torres Ray and I represent the Senate. Sheldon has been in the on the House side as chair, and as Democratic chair. And we don't always have one, but there has been not recently a Republican participant in this particular chair. So if there's somebody around the table that's interested in this, I would urge you to talk to whoever we need to talk to, because it's a great little commission to belong to. We meet 4 times a year. We have an executive director, if you will, that is part-time on contract, does a wonderful job for us in terms of keeping the commission together. It involves 10 states. It's more than just the Mississippi River Parkway Commission in Minnesota. Each state going up and down the river, if you will, I guess not much going up, but is involved in the Parkway Commission at some level, and so we coordinate. We have interpretive centers up and down the river, New Orleans to Lake Itasca, actually, and so we identify those. They participate in our meetings as we have them, and if I didn't say it, we have 2 meetings per year someplace along the river. It could be Dubuque, it could be Tupelo, or whatever. And that's all good in terms of general coordination. But to the whole aspect here in Minnesota, we're about promoting the river from a lot of perspectives. Tourism for sure, environmental quality, maintaining the intrinsic qualities of the river, and being a participant in those kind of discussions is what the committee or commission does. If you've got this note, you can read a lot of figures. $11 billion worth of sales. I don't know if that's true or not, but there's a lot of money that goes into tourism along the Mississippi River, sales tax, and so on and so forth. More practically speaking, as you see the signs going up and down the river, as you know, the Great River Road and so on, we work with MnDOT on those. A couple of years ago, we went back to all of the so-called lookouts. I'll call them lookouts up and down the Mississippi. They were built in the 1930s. They were fairly dilapidated. They all, at this point in time, are in good condition and really an asset to tourism. We've got ambassador programs. We have websites, 239,000 hits last year. We have these fantastic maps that unbelievable people from all over the world want a Great River Road map, and we mail them out and distribute them through different ways and tourism centers up and down the river. I won't go on, just to say it's a good little commission, and it does really good work for the state of Minnesota. I've been on it, as I said, since 2003, and I wouldn't want to get off it, because I just marvel at what they do. So I'll just stand for questions.
Any questions for the Senator? Here's our chance now to grill the Senate.
Right.
Seeing no questions, thank you, Senator.
Thank you very much for the time. Really appreciate it.
And welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape. And
my name is Representative Jen Schultz, and I'm here to speak about the Great Lakes Commission. So this is a commission that I've been a member of for 4 years. The Great Lakes Commission consists of elected officials from Minnesota, so I serve on it with Senators Ann Ress, Senator Carrie Rood, and Representative Paul Torkelson. And the other commissioners of the Great Lakes Commission make up the Great Lakes states and two Canadian provinces. And so we're a very bipartisan, binational group, and we serve to promote the Great Lakes and to preserve the Great Lakes. So we are focused on economic development and sustainability, habitat restoration, invasive species. We look at how we can restore the waterfront and revitalization, habitat restoration, commercial navigation, water management, water quality. We work on blue accounting issues, and we advocate for the Great Lakes Restoration Initiative. And so the last 4 years, we've been working to make sure that it's fully funded at $300 million per year. Recently, we secured funding to address the area of concern of the St. Louis River in my neighborhood of Duluth, and that was federal funding of $47.2 million and then state funding of $25 million to address that area of concern. And we're advocating right now currently to build a second post-sized Sioux lock. We're working on bolstering the cruising industry by making it easier to enter ports of entry, and then looking at contaminants of emerging concern and restoring wildlife and fish habitat. It's a very important region in terms of, if you thought of the Great Lakes region as a country, it is a $6 trillion economy, the third largest in the world. It creates about directly and indirectly 51 million jobs. There's 200 million tons of cargo that go through the Great Lakes and St. Lawrence River, and it's really the growth engine of North America. So the work we do is really important in terms of working with other states to make sure that we protect the water and how it's used in our region and promote economic development of the region.
Thank you. Any
and
questions?
I have two handouts.
Yep, they were passed out. Yep.
Excellent. With those important economic statistics, but we use the, there's a fee to be a member of the Great Lakes Commission, and we travel to an annual conference in the fall, and then we travel to D.C. to do advocacy and to celebrate the Great Lakes at the Great Lakes Day. And currently, our chair of the Great Lakes Commission is our own MPCA Commissioner John Linkstein, our former MPCA Commissioner John Linkstein. And now that he's no longer our commissioner, we're looking to see if he's reappointed for the next year or if they'll appoint a new chair of the Great Lakes Commission.
Thank you. Any questions? Quiet bunch this morning.
Okay. Thank you.
I think next is Ryan Inman from the Office of Revisers of Statutes. Welcome to the committee, and state your name for the tape.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Ryan Inman. I am your current reviser of statutes. Thank you for inviting us to the committee this morning to talk about the work that we do. What I'll do is provide a brief overview of what we do on a daily basis to support your work, and then we'll do a brief overview of our budget and a couple of the challenges that we're currently facing moving forward. As far as general information is concerned, we are a joint nonpartisan staff office of the Minnesota Legislature. So we differ a little bit from, say, House Research and House Fiscal in that we serve both bodies. So we work for both the Senate and for you. Our services are provided on a confidential basis. We were founded in 1939, and our duties are codified under Minnesota Statutes Chapter 3C. So that's sort of the guidebook for everything that we do for you. We've got 58 permanent and temporary employees currently on staff. Our permanent complement is a little bit down this year. We've got a number of more temporaries than we normally have because we've had a bit of turnover over the course of the last year. We provide legal and legislative services to both the House, the Senate, and other state agencies as provided by law. That includes bill drafting services provided to the executive branch and to the governor's office, other constitutional officers like the AG and the Secretary of State. Our duties are primarily divided into three different areas. We've got legislative responsibilities, we've got publication responsibilities, and we have IT responsibilities. So I'll touch on each of those really briefly. As far as legislative services are concerned, we provide bill drafting, amendment drafting, and resolution drafting services the same way that, say, House Research does. The one difference in that process for our office is that we jacket all of the bills and resolutions for introduction by both bodies. And so what that means is that you get a really rigorous quality control check before your bills are introduced in the House or the Senate. Later on in session, instead of staffing committees, we provide a little bit more of a back-of-the-house type support for the legislature. We produce division reports and division engrossments. We do committee reports and engrossments of bills. And so for the new members, engrossments are basically a new version of the bill. Once your committee acts on the bill with amendments, we take those amendments and incorporate them into the underlying bill to create a new draft of the bill that you'll work on in future committees. As session wears on, we begin preparing a series of different documents. One of them would be a side-by-side report. When you're working on the large omnibus finance bills or policy bills, oftentimes there'll be some differences between the House and the Senate language. And so what we'll do is we'll put both of those bills onto one sheet of paper to help facilitate conference committee work so that you can see where both of the bodies are. We also do desk comparison reports, which assist the chief clerk and the secretary of the Senate to determine whether or not bills have been passed in identical form. And we prepare the conference committee reports at the end of session. And so what that does is it's the final agreement, essentially, with respect to the large finance and omnibus bills. Those are what are the bills that are the forms of the bills that are acted on by the bodies before they're sent to the governor for his signature. Again, it's really important to note the quality control role we play with respect to all of these documents. Every single legislative document that our staff works on goes through multiple layers of review. We're checking for form. We're making sure that all the legal requirements are met. We're looking for constitutional issues, and then more mundane things like grammar, making sure that 7 million doesn't read 700 million. We also have legal publication duties. That's sort of the second piece of what we do, and this is what occupies most of our interim. We are the official publisher for the state of Minnesota for laws of Minnesota, Minnesota statutes, and for Minnesota rules. And so those are published each year. Laws are published around August 1st, so around the time that those laws are enacted, that work occurs typically in June. And what we do is we compile all of the bills that have been presented to the governor for his signature or veto. We edit them and compile them in those gold-colored books that you'll see behind the chair there. Once that work is done, we begin taking the general and permanent provisions that were passed by the legislature and we incorporate them into the statutory publication. And so in even years, we do the full publication. That is about 15 volumes, and those are the ones that are sitting behind the chair as well. And in odd-numbered years, we do a supplement. It's a little bit unwieldy to do the massive publication each year, so we do a supplement in the odd-numbered years. We're also responsible for publishing Minnesota rules. The timeline for that basically flips from statutes. In odd-numbered years, we do the full publication. Even-numbered years, we do the supplement publication, and we update those online on a rolling basis because they're not restricted temporally the way we are with respect to legislative work. We publish all of these documents both in print and electronically, and both of those versions are designated as official, which means they can be used in courts and legal proceedings. We also provide a wide range of information technology services. We provide network storage, processing, data, VoIP. We support all of that work and all of those services that that you need to get your work done. We maintain the data center, which is just around the corner here in the basement of the state office building. We also have in-house developed and maintained the Extend system, which is really the engine for all the work that we do. It's what we use to draft bills, create engrossments and enrollments. It's what the journals use to help build their publications at the end of the years. We maintain a permanent database of Minnesota law. That's what's pulled for the public website, what we use for bill drafting. And then we maintain support for legislative website functionality, both with respect to the legal publications and the bill tracking system. We provide a few additional services. We enroll and present all of the passed acts to the governor on behalf of the legislature, so we're the legislature's presentment agent. We serve as legal counsel in an unofficial capacity for members. If you've got questions about the current effect of particular laws or the effect of bills, we're happy to have those discussions with you. We also serve as counsel to the Joint House Senate Subcommittee on Claims, which I believe Representative Quam knows well. We provide administrative rule drafting support services to the executive branch as required by statute, and we also assist the courts publish their court rules. Every 2 years, we publish a court opinions report, which is essentially goes through all of the case law from the Minnesota Court of Appeals and the Minnesota Supreme Court for the past 2 years, where those cases identified deficiencies in statutes, whether it's ambiguity, unconstitutionality, vagueness, those sorts of things. So we compile those cases, provide captions so that the legislature can take a look at those and decide whether or not they want to act. We also do the revisers bill and the corrections bill, which are two technical bills that are intended to correct errors that have been made either in the drafting process or if there's obsolete text after various laws have been passed. And then we're responsible for maintaining all of the drafting standards that the legislature uses. So we have a revisers manual that we try to publish on a routine basis that contains a lot of information with respect to bill drafting, the standards that we use when we review your bills. So that's sort of a very quick 30,000-foot view of what we do. I'm happy to take questions. Otherwise, we can move on to the budget piece.
Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Inman, curious about what the utilization is of your paper printouts of the laws versus online usage, and if what determines the amount of paper volumes of the lovely books that are behind the chair that you print every 2 years?
Mr. Inman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, that is an ongoing process that we've been trying to figure out over the course of years. Our print publications have certainly decreased over the past 10 or 15 years. I don't have the numbers in front of me. I'd be happy to provide them to you. The contracts that we have with our publishers specify that we need to buy a certain number of copies, otherwise they won't be able to run them anymore. We still are able to provide a large number of them, both for state agencies and the legislative services folks here, free of cost, and I know that the state state bookstore sells a number of those copies as well. We obviously see more hits on the website than I think that you would see volumes that are sold, but it's certainly an ongoing concern that we have long term as to what the future of the print publication really is.
Mr. Inman, I know a few years back they started working on tracking the rulemaking process and publishing the rules and putting those online so people could follow that, similar to how we track our bills. Is that up and running, or are we still doing that?
Mr. Chair, yes, with a bullet. We had established the beta MARS, it's not the MARS system, but the beta rule status system, which is online right now. It's basically a data dump. We've tried to pull as many historic rulemaking records as we possibly can. We've relied very heavily on the executive branch for that information. And it is published online and available. It isn't the formal MARS system that was, we did a study on that a couple years back and published that report and provided it to the legislature. I know there were discussions about the MARS system the prior biennium, but they didn't really go anywhere. And so we're certainly willing to continue that discussion, but ultimately, from our perspective, MARS and its fate is really dictated by what the legislature is interested in and what the executive branch is interested in.
Thank you. Any more questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Inman. How many terabytes is the storage of, you've got the repository that's searchable, etc.? And then just about how many terabytes annually do you do with drafting all of our bills and amendments? I'm just curious. It's got to be huge.
Mr. Inman.
Chair Nelson, Representative Quam, I don't have that number right off of the top of my head for you. I'd be happy to try to pull it. I think it would be difficult to differentiate between the various data as to what each type, how much it is. How much is taken up by each document or each type of data that we keep, but I certainly can let you know how much storage we are capable of holding. I know that we have increased our storage capabilities by a fairly substantial amount, more than double over the past 5 or 10 years. Fairly substantial. Just by way of information, we actually have we've opened over 2,400 bill and resolution documents so far for this session, a week and a half in. If that provides any information with respect to the volume.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Inman. The legislature is undertaking a new structure in terms of how we process legislation, moving from an engrossment, if you will, to a divisional structure with memos. In light of that, how will the revisor's office identify updated information for the various committees, quite even possibly on a daily basis, as they move between committees by memo by virtue of the decisions of the Chair of Ways and Means? How will the revisor's office be complicated by that, or how are you anticipating and ramping up to provide services to the various committees based upon those decisions?
Mr. Inman.
Chair Nelson, Representative Albright, it's my understanding that the final details with respect to these processes haven't been entirely nailed down. We've certainly been a part of those discussions. From our perspective, we're going to try to treat these documents as closely to the process that members may have been familiar with over the past several years as possible. We're using different colored paper to identify whether it's a document from a committee versus a division, those sorts of things, just to highlight those items. It's really going to be a team effort between House Research, our office, the committee staff, and the Chief Clerk's office to make sure that we're able to track these things in a manner that is transparent and meets the needs of both the members and the public.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Inman, so just to follow on to that, so let's just role play a little bit for the sake of argument. Let's just say that the same bill is heard in one committee in the morning, and then it's heard in a different committee in the afternoon, but it was amended in the morning. What process would the revisor's office undertake in order to provide the afternoon committee hearing with the updated version of that memo or of that piece of legislation?
Mr. Inman.
Chair Nelson, Representative Albright, the process would look much the same as the processes that we use for, say, a standard committee report. We'll create a document that basically compiles all of the amendments together, and then we'll create a separate engrossment that will engross those amendments into the bill. We'll make every effort to turn those around as quickly as possible. During the deadline weeks, there may be difficulties with doing that given the volume and the size of the bills that will be moved around. There are other ways to ensure that all of those amendments are captured, including stapling them to the underlying engrossment, and then we'd be able to make a multi-division engrossment later on if necessary. But our primary objective will be, the minute we get those amendments, to start working them into the new engrossment so that it's available as quickly as possible.
And so, Mr. Inman, is this radically different from how we've operated in the past, or is it just a tweak and a little bit different way of doing it?
Chair Nelson, it is certainly different than what we've done in the past, but from our internal processes are concerned, we're treating them as closely to what we've had in the past in order to maintain as much efficiency as we can. By treating them similarly to the prior version of the documents, we'll be able to act on them faster. There will be less confusion on our end.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the point that the Chair made, and to kind of go back to the conversation that you and I were having, Mr. Inman, so under a legal definition, then, are we changing the definition legally of what an engrossment is?
Mr. Inman.
Chair Nelson, Representative Albright, there are already different types of engrossments that we provide. There are the engrossments that you think of in the traditional sense for committee reports that have been adopted by the full body. We've also done what are called committee engrossments when there have been, say, a division within the tax committee, the property tax division, where we send those up. This process is a little bit more equivalent to that second example. So I wouldn't say it's a radical departure from what has been done. But there are equivalents that we've done in the past, but it is certainly different than the way it was done during the previous biennium.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Inman, you mentioned coloration of the various, will that be by committee or will it be by time of amendment? Or I know that you haven't finalized the particulars, but from a standardization issue in terms of what color that we would recognize for specific activities or actions, how will that be communicated to the full body?
Mr. Inman.
Chair Nelson, Representative Albright. My understanding as to where the process is heading is that the forms used by the committees will be of a uniform color that is different from, say, the white paper that you're accustomed to seeing. So a division engrossment may be printed on brown paper or a different color that indicates that it is a division engrossment instead of a, say, the first engrossment of House File 1.
Thank you, Mr. Inman. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Mr. Inman. On the House floor, when, you know, discussion of the rules came up, I believe I heard that this was like how the Senate does stuff. Is this process we're doing this year with the temporary rules like the Senate, so it's not really something new?
Mr. Hinman.
Chair Nelson, Representative Quam, the services that we provide for the Senate are distinct from those we provide to the House. We review engrossments, so the engrossed bills after they've been amended. The Senate handles their own committee reports, so I'm not really in a position to comment on how their process works. So I know that they have had in the past division structures, but with respect to how they've handled that internally, we're not involved, so I can't comment on that directly.
Any further questions? If not, thank you for your time and for the information.
You're welcome.
I think the next person is Elizabeth Lincoln from the Legislative Reference Library. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Great. Thank you. My name is Elizabeth Lincoln, and I'm the director of the Legislative Reference Library. Thanks for the chance to speak. I'd be glad to answer any questions about the library at any time. I love to talk about the library. The library began in 1969, so it's our 50th year. But the mission to provide information, resources needed by the legislature has remained unchanged. What does the library do? We answer questions. You may take advantage of that service, but even if you don't contact us directly, I'm sure we're helping your staff and from the various research offices who serve you by finding background information, a report, statistics for them. We answered over 6,000 reference questions last year. Our collection of print and electronic materials is focused on state-level public policy issues, on current and historical information on the Minnesota legislature as well. We're also Minnesota's depository library, so that means that documents from state agencies, boards, and task forces and commissions, we collect those, and we also digitally archive all those state documents so that years from now, even if an agency doesn't exist or they've purged documents from their website, all of those documents are available through our website. These important documents provide transparency into the operations of state government and agencies and programs. We also carefully track all of the studies and reports that are required by the legislature each year. We have a terrific magazine collection of state public policy magazines and newsletters. With our custom alerting services, members and staff can follow specific magazines or get articles by topics that interest them. The library's custom alerting services maximizes the access to our great collection of periodicals. The requests for magazine articles through our two custom services have increased steadily. We provide over 12,000 article requests per year through those two services alone. The library also pays for key electronic resources for users within the Capitol complex. Many legislators and staff take advantage of the Star Tribune passwords available through the library. In addition to that, the library provides the archives of many Minnesota and most national newspapers back to the 80s for anyone on a legislative computer. Other electronic resources include access to tens of thousands of online full-text magazine articles through database vendors such as EBSCO, JSTOR, and ProQuest. We provide specialized databases for the staff that need them. For example, we subscribe to Bloomberg B BNA tax library for all the nonpartisan tax staff, and Westlaw for members and staff or attorneys. Library staff work closely with other legislative staff for the smooth functioning of the legislature's website. Library staff were deeply involved in the redesign of the legislature's website this past summer, and we are currently, library staff are managing the legislative website's new search engine. The library is also involved in archiving legislative history materials. So we archive the audio and video files of both the House and Senate for permanent retention. We received an appropriation in 2017 to digitize 29,000 cassette and reel-to-reel tapes of legislative hearings and floor sessions back to 1991. Now that that project is complete, the audio files are available to all the audio files of legislative hearings that are currently in existence are available digitally, so anyone can listen to them anytime they want to. We also collect the minutes of the House and Senate committees for permanent retention and public access. We compile and publish historical legislative statistics, including data on the length of sessions, numbers of bills introduced and laws passed, caucus strength, and vetoes. Most of the statistics we compile go back to 1858. Another rich database of historical material is our biographical database of the 5,320 legislators who have served the state of Minnesota. We also maintain databases of gubernatorial materials, executive orders, state of the states, and reorganization orders, because there isn't a gubernatorial office that maintains those long term. You can see our budget in the documents that Greg distributed. Our primary cost obviously is for staff. It's 89% of our budget. We currently have 14 staff in 13.25 full-time equivalent of positions, and six of us are librarians. The next biggest item is supplies, which includes books, magazines, and newspapers, not surprising for a library. The library is on the sixth floor of the state office building, as well as the small, we have a small reading room in the Senate building on the third floor there. Even though our goal is to make sure that all of our resources are available to you and your staff on your laptop or your phone, we're happy to see you stop by either one of our spaces. Thank you for the opportunity to speak, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Albright.
Thank you. This is not a silly question, but can you check things out from the library? Or do you have to be in the library? I mean, do I have a need a library card, or do I need to sign something out? Do I have a penalty if I don't bring it back in time?
And you can check out anything you'd like, and we don't charge any, just like the St. Paul Public Library, there's no overdue fees.
And my follow-up,
Mr. Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm intrigued by the search mechanism that you mentioned for topic-specific. Could you just go into that in terms of how we could set that up for the benefit of all members that are maybe topic-specific based upon if it's healthcare, if it's technology or taxation? Is it an alpha search? Could you just briefly just describe how we might put that together for ourselves?
So, Ms. Lincoln, if we want to search Representative Rukavina talking about Spunky, could we get that?
Yeah.
Well, there's
Ms. Lincoln.
Representative Albright and Chair Nelson. We have two different services. We have an internal newspaper database that we would be able to pull up the Spunky story. So we can search that on your behalf, or we can tell you how to do that. But we also have the customized services that that are available to you and any other staff person are sent out each week. And if you identify transportation, finance, or some topic like that that you would like to follow, you'll get a list of citations each week to those journals that have articles in that topic, and then you can just click on it and we can send it to you within a day or so. Many of you already take advantage of that service, so I will send you some information, and the new subscriptions will be going out this week too.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Representative Albright.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Well, thank you, Ms. Lincoln.
Great. And thanks for the opportunity to speak.
And next we have Susan Lincheski from the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Welcome to the committee. Please state your name for the tape.
Thank you, Chair Nelson. My name is Susan Lencheski, and I am the director of the Legislative Commission on Pensions and Retirement. Many of you have served or may serve on that commission this coming session. Why do we need a commission for this purpose? My view is that it's a big chunk of our economy in the state of Minnesota. The trust holds about $90 billion in assets for benefits for about a half million individuals in our state. So it's an important job. I think the commission is comprised of people who are interested in the topic or have expertise in pensions, and so it is a very helpful group of people who can provide some good policy decisions related to this this big chunk of assets and individuals. The commission spends most of its time considering bills related to pensions and retirement topics. It's a 14-member commission, typically meets, it's bipartisan, as mentioned, so we've got 7 members from the Senate, 7 from the House. The majority can have 5 members from each. That's the limit, so it has been 5-2 in the last session. The commission has 3 full-time staff members, myself, a new analyst who is replacing Rachel Barth, who had been the deputy director, and he's just come on about a week ago. And then we have a full-time commission assistant, Lisa Dieslin, who is able to prepare bills. We do essentially the work of House Research, Senate Counsel, and the revisors in our little office, but with a very particular focus, which is on pensions and retirement. Last year, last session, we prepared 19 bills, 27 amendments, 8 background memos, and summaries of 6 iterations of our bill. If you recall, we had about a 245-page pension bill that did manage to make its way all the way through to enactment. It had about $33 million in appropriations in that bill. That's all I have on the commission. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Representative Albright.
Mr. Chair, I have served on the pension committee for the last two biennia, and I can honestly say that Ms. Lencheski is a very valued member of that team and does yeoman's work on behalf of all of the members of the committee. So just a thank you to the work that the commission does on behalf of both the Senate and the House.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and Representative Albright. Thank you.
And I have to echo that. Having served on it off and on it in the past, it is we get good service out of that, and it takes some of those complicated issues having to deal with pensions and gets them before the legislature so that in a way that we're not all having to fight over them and understand them, because they are sometimes very complicated issues.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Any further questions? Well, thank you for that. Thank you, Ms. Lencheski, and have a nice day from now on. Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair, members, we're here now to talk about the LCC itself. There's a one-page summary in your handout that summarizes some of the office's responsibilities. We have 8 full-time staff, 2 part-time staff, an operating budget of about $1.2 million. We also manage a separate account called fiscal agents that is largely pass-through money. That's another $1 million a year. We have 3 areas of responsibilities. One is, as I indicated earlier, to support a number of task forces and commissions that are on that large organizational chart. We do that with the support of the folks in House Research and Senate Counsel and Fiscal Analysis. They are an integral part of that team of nonpartisan staff that support these councils and commissions. We also provide administrative and fiscal support to the commissions and councils. We manage the time card and payroll system. We provide RFP and contract management support to them. We provide HR support to the roughly 140 joint staff. Our GIS office provides IT support to the legislative commissions as well. And finally, the LCC provides coordination services for the budget, budget development proposal. The LCC, under our statute, is to review and recommend a budget, a biennial budget for all the commissions and joint agencies, and that will happen later in the session. Then a separate area of responsibilities that we have is to provide administrative support to the work of the Senate and the House. We establish personnel and benefits policies that apply to House, Senate, and LCC staff. Whenever there's a bill that has a that's proposed that has a fiscal impact on the legislature, our office prepares that fiscal note that estimates the impact of that legislation. When we also maintain the legacy website, when the constitutional amendment was passed in 2008, raising the sales tax, that generates about $300 million a year. When the legislature was first starting to appropriate those funds, there was a lot of interest in making sure that how the state spends those funds is transparent to Minnesota's citizens. And so our office was tasked with the responsibility of developing a website that captures the spending from the dozen or so agencies that receive those appropriations and shows how that money is spent in programs and projects across the state. And that's available on the legislature's website. And then finally, our GIS office provides technical support to the redistricting process. That will happen in earnest in the 21 session. And so the GIS staff provide that technical support for collecting the data, collecting the proposals from the four caucuses, posting them, and doing the analysis that compares and provides standard reports. Couple of budget items that we'll be facing in developing our budget proposal. Our budgets are the same in the way as in the House and the Senate, where our budgets now are the same as they were in FY17. We had no change in the current biennium from the appropriations that were made 4 years ago. And in that time, of course, we've had increased costs, insurance, and compensation costs for employees, to mention one area. I mentioned a moment ago that the legislature will be undergoing the redistricting process in the 21 session. We provide that technical support. We have identified costs that will likely be incurred for the House and Senate for each of their caucuses and providing that to the House and Senate budget folks. We'll have some costs as well for temporary staff and for the software and hardware that's needed to process those plans. That's an overview of the LCC. I think we'll move now to the other fiscal agents part of the budget. There's a separate budget page in your handout that covers that. And Ms. Henry Wengenstein will talk about those, and we'll be bouncing back and forth for those line items.
Thank you very much. My name is Diane Henry Wengenstein. I'm the Deputy Director with the Legislative Coordinating Commission. So just looking at that page, just pointing out a few of the items, the high-level items and things. The LCC provides facilitates the accommodation arrangements for public access to the legislature as required under ADA. Primarily, that's for sign language interpreters, but also may be accommodations for translation to Braille large font format prints. We contract with service providers or work with service at state entities as state services for the blind. We provide information to the legislature staff on how to do these type of arrangements, or we also work with legislative staff, and also we post information for the public as well. So cost for this can vary, depends upon demand of it then as well. So,
Mr. Chair, members, the next two lines relate to the dues for national organizations that the legislature is a member of. The National Conference of State Legislature provides research support to members and staff, as does the Council of State Government. The LCC receives the appropriation to pay for those annual dues. Those have increased somewhat, about 3 or 4% a year, so we'll be requesting an increase to cover the cost of those dues.
The next couple lines are some committees that Greg pointed out originally. We talked about the overview of the LCC and some of the joint commissions, those being the region's candidate advisory council, the board of trustees candidate advisory council, and planning and fiscal policy. We have a contingency budget that we keep for just kind of contingencies, if those come up. Another thing that we also have is the indirect cost. The MMB has statutory authority to charge indirect and special billing to state agencies. Indirect is provided, indirect is defined as something that's for supportive services by, provided by MMB to all state agencies, stuff like central payroll, IT services, and central mail. Special billing is for statewide services, such as like the budget system, fiscal notes, and other things such as that. LCC has been paying the indirect and special billing on behalf of the legislature. Costs can vary, but you see the cost in that table as well. You already heard about the Great Lakes Commission and the Mississippi River Parkway Commission. Just a little bit about public TV then, too. The LCC manages the broadcast contracts on behalf of House Public Information Office and Senate Media. The LCC facilitates also the caption arrangements for both the broadcast and the webcast of this, as required by the FCC. We issue RFPs. We go through contract negotiations. Our current contract is with MPTA for the broadcast, has been for many years now. Caption contracts varies. We have various contracts with different providers. Annually, our cost for our public contract with MPTA is approximately $570,000. Contracts with the different caption providers approximately cost on the biennium about $140,000. The website contracts that's for the broadcast contract captioning. For website captioning, the cost is approximately about $175 per biennium. And we also use some of the remaining funds within the allocation budget to buy hardware and software that supports the telecast and broadcast system. Most of these things I talked about, all these funds come from the general fund, except for the LCC also receives a special appropriation from the Telecommunication Access Fund for facilitating caption services for the webcast then as well.
Then the last item on that list is the Permanent School Fund Commission. This is a commission that made up of House and Senate members that pays particular attention to the school trust lands, and they meet regularly throughout the year and make recommendations to the legislature on legislation affecting those funds. One item that's not on the list is the Legislative Salary Council. I think Mr. Gehring mentioned this at a meeting earlier this week. That's the citizen council appointed by the Chief Justice and the governor that will determine salaries for legislators beginning in July. The LCC under the statute is to provide administrative support to the work of that council. We will be seeking an appropriation to pay for those members' per diems and expense reimbursements. That's a quick run through, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hubinger. I have a couple of questions, and with the redistricting, we should be expecting then budget requests for additional money to help with the redistricting process?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Okay, and then the other question I have is a gentleman that's around here a lot that's talking about accessibility of documents, being able to read them. Are the documents you provide on your website accessible to the people that have trouble with reading and whatnot?
Mr. Chair and members, the legislature has long had a commitment to making all of its services available and accessible to all Minnesotans. And we pay particularly attention to the documents that are posted to the legislature's website. That's a long, this is a major effort to make documents accessible in a number of different formats. A challenge that the legislature has in a committee setting when you are inundated with handouts and materials from the public and from state agencies and from other entities that may or may not be accessible. The handout that we provided today hasn't been posted yet. That was authored by all of the folks that you saw this morning in different offices in different software packages. And so while most of that's accessible, some of it is not. And we will be working to make those changes make it available in an accessible format. But that's a challenge for the legislature as an institution. Representative Thiessen and Senator Westrum had legislation last session that would require the legislature formally to comply with the federal accessibility standards. We did a draft of a fiscal note to comply with that. I think that was in the range of $2 million a year for the staffing that would be required to be available to more quickly ameliorate the documents to make them accessible.
I just that I hear from him a lot, and I have other interactions outside of the Capitol with him, so that's why I asked the question. Any other further questions? Representative Quam.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I have some curiosity because I believe there are some new software packages for recognition, and the problem is you scan it in, and it populates, and you have to have an actual person verify it. Are there any ones that have AI-assisted corrective, adaptive that might speed up?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chen, Representative Quam, Minute Services has an office that is focused on helping the state comply with the federal standards, and there are staff from the legislature that are participate in a committee that works on exactly those issues about how the state complies with those standards. I'm not familiar with artificial intelligence as a means for doing that task, and I'm assuming that committee is working on that.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Hubinger, we're all probably pretty aware of what occurred the summer before last with the litigation between the governor's office and both the House and the Senate in terms of a disagreement over funding for the chambers. And the LCC was pulled into that or drawn into that fray. And some of the resources, of my understanding, were used to extend out salaries and whatnot for the members. Has the LCC's funding balance been made whole in response to that by both chambers?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chen, Representative Albright. The leadership worked with the LCC, and we did a number of transfers to support members or the costs of the House and Senate during that time. And then when the appropriations were reestablished the following year, we were made whole. The LCC, from its sources, paid for the costs for the law firm that represented the legislature's interest.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Hubinger, to that point, were you reimbursed for those costs as well?
Mr. Hubinger.
Mr. Chair, Representative Albright, we were not.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Green.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a simple question. If I missed this, if you talked about it, I apologize. But both for the LCC contingency and public television, excuse me, the actual for 2018 was substantially lower than the actual for 2017. So my question is, did the costs go down, or are all the bills in yet for 2018?
Mr. Hubinger, Ms. Wagenstein.
Chair members, there's the difference is typically a long session and a short session. So with our broadcast contracts with public television, we pay, throughout the year on a long session, per day, and a shorter session is much shorter. So with captioning, it's the same way as that too.
Representative Green, any further questions? Well, thank you, and I think the next one on the list here is the Michelle Weber from the Legislative Budget Office. Welcome to the committee, and please state your name for the tape and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm Michelle Weber, and I'm the Director of the Legislative Budget Office. I appreciate the opportunity to come before you today and talk a little bit about the office, of which until yesterday I was the sole person within the office, so I did have someone join me yesterday. The materials related to the Legislative Budget Office, there's a handout in the last page of your packet that provides an overview of the office, and in about the middle of the packet, you'll find the budget for the office. The Legislative Budget Office is the newest office, joint office at the legislature. It was created during the 2017 legislative session to serve both the House of Representatives and the Senate by providing fiscal notes to the legislature on bills that are under consideration. During the 2018 legislative session, there were changes to the initial legislation associated with the creation of this office that extended the implementation period for the office and has this year as a transition for the office to be established, staff to be brought on board, and to work with Minnesota Management and Budget, the executive branch agency that currently is responsible for the oversight and provision of fiscal notes to the legislature, on that as an opportunity to learn from them about the process and develop standards and procedures for this office to assume responsibility on September 1st of this year. The Legislative Budget Office has a Legislative Budget Office Oversight Commission. I, as the director of the Legislative Budget Office, serve as the secretary to that commission. It is an 8-member commission, has 4 members from the House of Representatives, 4 members from the Senate, 2 from the majority and 2 from the minority in each body, so not a bipartisan oversight commission. And then there are ex officio members that also serve on that commission: the budget director at Minnesota Management and Budget, the legislative auditor, the chief fiscal analyst of the House, and the lead fiscal analyst of the Senate serve as ex officio members of that oversight commission. The budget for this office in fiscal year 19, our current fiscal year, is $864,000, and it does include some one-time costs related to the establishment of the office. So approximately $46,000 of that is for setup of the office, equipment for staff, and things of that nature. The ongoing base budget for the office is $816,000 on an annual basis. The funding will primarily support staff. There is also built into the funding a contract between the Legislative Budget Office and Minnesota Management and Budget for the fiscal note tracking system. That's the technical system that is used to facilitate fiscal note requests, the development of fiscal notes, which are primarily developed by state agencies that are impacted by the legislation, and then the review of those fiscal notes, ultimate submission to the legislature and publication for the public. So we wouldn't be developing a new system. We would be leveraging that existing technical system that exists, and the Legislative Budget Office has entered into a contract with Minnesota Management and Budget for that purpose. There are two budget pressures facing the office. So one is where the office will be located. There's the possibility that there would be leased space for the office. As the Oversight Commission has had discussions, there's strong interest in having the office in a location that is other than the same location that either the House or Senate members are located in. And so options that have been considered include the State Capitol, the Centennial Office Building, and then also leased space just across the street from the Senate, from the Minnesota Senate Building. So that the current budget may not facilitate costs associated with leasing space for the office. Also, one of the risks that has been identified is the level of staffing that is supported in the current appropriation for the office. Currently, the office, the funding that's available would provide 6.5 full-time equivalent staff. And during the 2017-18 biennium, over the two-year period, there were approximately 2,500 fiscal notes that were processed during that time. So it's a pretty significant quantity for a small number of staff. And so I am working with the LCC and others on a potential request for additional funding for staff for the office. Between now and September 1st, when the office assumes responsibility for the fiscal note process, I'll be bringing on staff. Currently, the other positions for the office are posted. I'm hoping to bring staff on in March so that the staff have the opportunity to observe the process during the legislative session, also the ability to develop the expertise necessary to review and analyze information from the agencies. before submission to the legislature. And one of the things that's required in the law is the development of uniform standards and procedures related to the fiscal note process. Those uniform standards and procedures are subject to approval by the Oversight Commission and then are required to be posted in the State Register by September 1st. So that concludes my overview. I am happy to stand for any questions.
Representative Kwa.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Has there any been, when I'm thinking of your duties for the area, it's very peak driven. You know, there are certain times where it's really heavy. Is there a thought of looking at past employees of the legislature that have done fiscal activities, bring them in a part-time, if you're retired, coming back and working during that rush, you might have some institutional background and people that would enjoy a little bit of it for a few weeks as opposed to, you know, the rest of the year. I mean, what type of staffing options have you looked at? Because, you know, frankly, we all know you've got a few weeks where it's going to be no sleep, and then it's sort of slower for most the rest of the time.
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Kwam, that is one of the recent ideas that has come forward. I've been talking with the nonpartisan fiscal staff in both the House and Senate to see if there are alternatives that we can identify other than increasing the staff complement within the office. One was an idea around bringing back individuals who have retired who may be interested in a short-term position and responsibility. One of the things that as I have worked over the last few months is the changing dynamics of the policy and legislation that might be under consideration. So there are some skills that would be transferable, financial, analytical skills, things of that nature. But as I've talked with both fiscal analysts in the House and Senate, and I've talked with the Legislative Auditor Office about how long does it take to train staff and have them develop the necessary expertise for their content area. Some have said, I've been here 7 or 10 years, and I'm still learning because there's always new emerging issues that are coming forward. And so in considering part-time staff, that's been a less attractive idea because of that nature of being able to know what's the context around this legislation being under consideration as well, and having some ability to have some background and have done some research and so forth on it. So, but that is one of the options that we did talk about. There are other options that we've also talked about around, is there a way we can, through the legislative process, maybe manage that quantity of fiscal note requests that might come forward to be able to manage it with a lesser staff. But that also would require pretty significant change at the legislature as well.
Representative Mason.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
It's early.
Ms. Weber, right now, I just want to get a few things clarified here. There are people that are providing this service right now that are employed, right?
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Mason, yes, that's correct. The oversight and responsibility for fiscal note policies and procedures and the review of fiscal notes prior to submission to the legislature is currently being provided by Minnesota Management and Budget and Executive Budget Officers within the Budget Division there.
Representative Mason.
My question then is, between if you want to hire people in March and originally your office becomes official in September, so we have two sets of people doing essentially the same job, and it is your intent to transfer some of the people currently doing that job into your office, or are you setting up an entirely new staff?
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and Representative, there is not a provision of transferring staff. So the Legislative Budget Office, we have created positions and posted the availability for those positions. Anybody could apply for them. And so there also was not a corresponding reduction in the level of staff at Minnesota Management and Budget. When this office was created, the staff at Minnesota Management and Budget provide additional work other than just fiscal notes. So they work on the forecast, the governor's budget, end of session tracking, and things of that nature, as well as fiscal notes. During the period between now and September 1st, the staff in the Legislative Budget Office would not be performing the same functions as those staff in Minnesota at Minnesota Management and Budget, but would be working with Minnesota Management and Budget to be trained and oriented and develop expertise on the work related to fiscal notes so that they're prepared to assume responsibilities on September 1st.
Representative Mason.
Thank you.
Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ms. Weber, just going back to what you were saying around, you know, the number of staff and when looking at what happened in 2017, 2018, the 2,500 fiscal notes, and just thinking about kind of the intent of this office and the conversations around timeliness and expedient, we need to get our fiscal notes to go with bills when we have hearings and whatnot, and that was some of the conversation around this last year, as well as other things. Can you just give a sense of what you're thinking about the ability, timeliness to ensure that this is actually going to be a more efficient way to get a fiscal note in a timely manner than the current setup or concerns? Just kind of speak to that piece would be helpful.
Ms. Weber.
Mr. Chair and Representative Olson, yes, one of the goals of this office is to increase the timeliness of fiscal notes, and under the current staff complement, I am concerned that we will not be able to achieve that goal, particularly because of that volume during about a 4 to 6 week time period in the middle of the legislative session. And so one of the things that I am pursuing and I think is the avenue would be additional staff within the office so that we do not, as a result of assuming this responsibility, compromise the timeliness of information being provided to the legislature.
Representative Olson.
Thank you.
Any further questions? If not, thank you for your testimony. And members, with that, if there's nothing else that needs to come before the committee, we're adjourned.